I had to clean up the data. It looks really weird if you look at volume chart. I added later on flash loan. Any transaction that had flash loans, I don't think that there's much reason to flash loan when you're trading NFTs in the same transaction. So I just flagged all those out. Those are the main heuristics I used.
Scraping Bits is brought to you by the following sponsors. MEV Protocol. Maximize your ETH staking value with MEV ETH. Exclusively on MEV.io. And Composable. Execute any intent on any chain, coming soon to mantis.app. That's mantis.app. And Fastlane Labs, the only MEV, an intent-centric team that has a daily deodorant application rate of over 68%. GM, GM, everyone. My name's Degachi, the host of Scraping Bits, and today I'm with HillW from Dragonfly. GM, GM, how's it going?
Hello, hello. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming on. I just called DM you on Twitter and here we are.
Yeah, I think I looked into the podcast a bit and it seemed very interesting and very focused on MEV, which is one of the topics I've been diving into quite a bit lately. So always keen on talking a bit more about this.
The secrets, the dark forest. For the people that aren't familiar with you, who are you and what do you do?
Before we start, I just want to caveat that everything I say represents my opinion and does not represent Dragonfly. So I do data at venture firm Dragonfly, and most of my work is contributing to public goods by releasing data sets and sharing dashboards and visualizations on Dune. So you can find my work mostly on Twitter, that's where I'll share everything, and then on my Dune profile. I've always done this for over 2 years. I started out of self-interest and being just curious about what is going on in the blockchain world and trying to understand it for myself through the eyes of data. And I eventually joined Dragonfly as the data guy there.
As the data guy. How did you get into data? Were you always doing it before, or was it just when you got into crypto, that's how you got into it?
I got into crypto after my bachelor. I did an internship at a company called Kaiko, which is a crypto company that focuses on central exchange data and basically pulling it from all central exchanges and selling it to anyone who needs it. So whether historical, whether current, whether it's WebSocket current stuff or full historical backlog. And that was where I started looking to crypto. Then I went to Amsterdam doing my master's. During it, I was working in a dairy data company on forecasting models. And while the work itself was interesting, I wasn't as interested in the topic. The dairy industry is pretty boring and stale. So especially when you compare it to crypto. And so I've always had crypto on the back of my mind. And then COVID happened. And during COVID, I found out about Dune. And I was like, okay, well, instead of me, needing to ingest my own data if I want to analyze anything, Dune does it for me. And on top of this, I can, create any data sets, visualizations just for myself for free and share it with everyone. And also, I don't need to maintain and Dune does it for me. I can, it runs forward. So you look at dashboards that are popular, they'll automatically get rerun probably every 5 hours or so. So the data remains current. And that's, not needing to worry about the whole backend thing. It's a huge unlock because now I can just look into the data itself, which is what is interesting to me, and spend a lot more time on it.
Yeah, you just get to focus on what really matters. That's what I really liked about blockchains in general, not specifically Dune, but you can just write a smart contract and then you don't need a back end and a front end. You can just write it. It's there. And it was super easy, streamlined kind of process. What drew you to data? Because I think, especially in this day and age where it's becoming more and more significant with AI, I think even people in any company, data matters, right? It reveals stuff that you wouldn't normally see just looking at the single transactions, for example. It reveals patterns and you can see abnormalities and utilize that. So how did you really get into it?
So in 2019, so I had started to buy some crypto and I was on crypto Twitter. And on crypto Twitter, all I could see were the only charts I could see were technical analysis charts, which are the most interesting to me. I don't think that's, especially when everyone talks about crypto as this open ledger where the whole thing is transparent, and surely like price action is not the only thing we can figure out. You know,
number go up.
So yeah, I was always like, I want to dig into this further, and also just for seeing the data, because it wasn't really accessible, where it was like paywalled in some places with like really, really expensive price points. And I thought, like, surely with this whole open source ethos and everything is like open to everyone, surely the data should be as well. And it really wasn't as much. So if you look back already on like over the past bull run, how much transparency in terms of data, there's been like tremendous progress. And I think that's kind of cool. So I kind of was part of this, or at least try to be, you know, take part into this. And I did this on June because it was the easiest to do it. And also because at the time it was definitely like the biggest company and where in terms of like user generated content for data. And I think it still is. I want to make sure that my work, when people search for something, like it is in the places people go to search for it. And that tends to be Dune. There's obviously other platforms, but I'm pretty happy I chose Dune still. And it was all about curiosity at first. And then over time, people, you know, started reaching out. I'm like, oh, this is interesting. Do you think you could look into this? And then I started having some, you know, commission work, whether public goods or private, there was a bit of both. And over time, I was still doing my master's, but, you know, it kind of dawned on me, like, surely this seemed like I'm just much more interested in this than finishing my master's. Everyone around me was like, no, you got to finish your master's. So I ended up not finishing my master's. And so I dropped out to go full into this and publish more, grow myself in the space and like publicly and trying to release more data sets that if you look at like what I've worked on, it's usually sector-wide analysis that no single entity is necessarily willing to commission, but everyone in that sector is interested in. So I don't know if that makes sense, but I started like the NFT data because that was what was really interesting at the time and what was, in the wake of like NFT summer or however you call it. And people were interested in like OpenSea data or this data or this data, but no one was really open to like commission the entire landscape. And that was, to me, what was more interesting rather than like a single company, because a single company doesn't mean much if you don't know how well it is doing relative to the others. I tend to do like sector-wide. NFT was the first one. Then I realized there was a bit of shady things going on in NFT trading. So I made like a wash trading filter that is also available on Dune for people to use. And then I moved on to other things. So another thing was e-staking and trying to make sense of like who is actually staking, like what are the entities who are staking in the space, and you know, what is the market share or how do you call it of each entity. And yeah, so that was a lot of tagging. And at first I did it, I think in like early 2022, when no one at the time really cared. And I got like 2 likes on that dashboard at first. And then eventually the merge came by and like, oh, now everyone's interested. So there's also a lot of this where the data I tend to make isn't necessarily interested right when I publish it, but it tends to, you know, come in waves of interest. And those tend to be more on the longer term rather than like as you publish. So there's also a lot of maintenance work that I try to do and try to make sure I actively keep on tagging people, adding marketplaces for NFT, adding new chains when there's a relevant new chain that pops up. Although for now, I'm mostly focused on EVM chains because in terms of structure, it's so much easier to go from Ethereum to Optimism or Polygon than to go from Ethereum to Solana. The work scales in that the methods I use for one chain work in the exact same way for all the other EVM chains. And that's pretty cool. So I'm increasingly working tools like cross-chain data. And so my more recent research has been more about like MEV. And I thought the data was still very hard to access. It was somewhat accessible for Ethereum already, but you know, even for Ethereum it was not that accessible. And I thought, how does it even look on the other chains? The beauty of doing it on Dune is my method works on all chains. So when I release the data, you can check it out for all chains, even though, you know, centralized sequences and stuff don't allow for as much activity as the mempool on Ethereum. I thought that's interesting, and it's going to evolve either way. So kind of interested in seeing how that will go over time. So yeah, over, I think I started somewhat in the early summer last year to look into MEV, and I had all the projects I was working on at the time, but it was always on the back of my mind that I want to eventually have MEV data available on Dune for me to look at in terms of how that looks, you know, and like current like monitor, but also for hopefully for other people to use those data sets and expand on them or go deeper into the research. It is a two parts thing. What I release it is the visual part, which are the dashboard, but also on the back end, which is most of the work actually, is the data sets that are behind it. And I guess it serves multiple use cases.
The thing is with MEV data, super hard to get unless you run something like a builder or a relay, because that's where all the interesting data is, like all the bundles, the blocks being sent from different builders. I mean, you could really analyze all of them and see these algorithms, right? If you're a relay, you could find how the builders, I guess, algorithms are running relative to yours if you were running one. But also, if you're a builder, you would see all of the transactions coming to you, aside from, you know, exclusive transactions. Unless there were exclusive transactions going on, you would be able to analyze what's happening at what times and what's triggering people to create these kind of bundles, all that stuff. But, you know, going back to the initial ones you did with the NFTs, and I think it was like end of 2022. I remember that era of Looks Rare when that came out. It really broke grounds. And you did an interesting thing with the wash trading, as you said before. And it's super crazy how when you look at the data of what you did on the Dune thing, you see how much money is being wash traded. And you managed to flag $30 billion of NFT wash trades. That's just an insane amount.
So yeah, when Looks Rare like released, I worked on the data and released on dashboard, and that was commissioned for them from them, like discussed this before their launch, but I wasn't necessarily too clued into what Looks Rare was going to look like and what it was going to be. I didn't necessarily know about like the token incentives and everything. So I just, you know, when it launched, like right when it launched, that's when I started, and I had like had to speed run the data so it's out as quickly as possible. And then if you looked into the early data, like the hourly volumes looked extremely weird. Like usually it is a somewhat of a nice flow of things where, you know, if you look at like DEX trading, like very more organic places are going to be very like, I don't know, the flow of the volume isn't going to be like crazy spikes and just outliers. And this just looked like outliers all over the place, which was weird. And, you know, digging into it further, there was, given the incentives, there was people wash trading. And I thought that's interesting, actually. And that's a good research area. And it is actually possible, you know, through heuristics. So I used a bunch of heuristics there. I can get into those afterwards to flag. But the problem is, while it works well in Ethereum, which is somewhat of a costly chain, it doesn't work as much on like other chains where it's much cheaper to do wash trading methods that are more complex. So you can, you know, send your NFT across a bunch of addresses, and it's just so cheap that it's the cost is fine for them. Whereas on Ethereum, you know, the costs are high. So when you want to wash trade, the whole goal is to minimize your costs. So people are sticking to the like simple methods, if that makes sense, to like wash trade. And those are what I flagged looking back. Wait, I'm opening up my wash chain, but the heuristics are like pretty simple. And I think that's also the beauty of what I liked in like the end product is, first of all, the data makes sense in terms of what I've been observing on the market. Like it's mostly flagging Looks Rare data. And that's what everyone was criticizing. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't OpenSea. You know, when I released it, the heurist to me made like 100% sense and no one really questioned them. And that was what I was happy about. It was like, you know, if no one questions them, everyone agrees on them and the data looks, it makes a lot of sense. So surely it works. And a good confirmation I've had lately is when I think in end of October, Looks Rare stopped their incentives on NFTs, NFT trading, and they moved their incentives towards, I think, their more gambling platform or I don't know, some other places of the marketplace. And right then you could see the volume die down right there, but also, you know, that surplus volume was exactly what was tagged as like wash trading. And so it was a perfect like back testing for my data set, being like, okay, so it does seem to work pretty well.
What were the heuristics you were using? How do you even determine the heuristics?
So to determine the heuristic, it is basically trying to reverse engineer the wash trader's brain and what would be the easiest method for you to wash trade on a platform. And there's a few of them. So one of them, some contracts, for example, allow for sender and recipient to be the same address. So that's pretty obviously like weird, you know? Then there is people trading back and forth between two addresses. That's also very weird. The same NFT, not necessarily different NFTs, because sure, you can. There's different scenarios that, especially at the time, there weren't. I mean, there still isn't a crazy amount, but you know, market makers are becoming, I guess, are starting to come by with Blur incentives and other platforms. I kind of view those as market makers, and therefore they tend to be flagged in some heuristics that I determined at a time when that wasn't really a behavior that was so trading back and forth. But also just another heuristic is like if an address has held in the past three different times the same NFT, it's bought the same NFT like three different times. And as those constant numbers are things I'll play around with and see what works. Obviously, I don't know if three is the most optimal, but it is the one I found at the time to be the most optimal. And so things evolve. The problem was people evolve, those strategies evolve. And I constantly look for new things. So for example, I think early in 2023, I started to see some, I don't know if you remember, there was this huge thing that popped up where CryptoPunk was bought for like $2 billion or something. And it was just it was a flash loan. And basically, you know, that was pretty annoying to see. So I had to clean up the data because it looks really weird if you look at volume charts. Now there's this huge spike that makes no sense. So I had to, I added later on flash loan, any transaction that had flash loans. I don't think that there's much reason to flash loan when you're like trading NFTs in the same transaction. So I just flagged all those out. Yeah, I think those are the main heuristics I used, if I remember correctly. I did a whole post on this, so you can also link to it. It's on my Dune profile. There's a whole wash trading dashboard alongside a written piece I shared with Dune.
Interesting. After you did like this whole NFT era, when it died down with, you know, OpenSea was such a massive like trend and it kind of died after some time. But after that, I mean, you did some MBV strategies, right? You eventually got into, you did a, what did you do? Atomic arbitrage?
So I've never actually done MBV myself. I've been interested in the space because it's been like a topic and everyone talks about MEV this past year. And I'm like, my main question was how much of the DEX volume is MEV? That was my main, like, how big of a thing is it relative to total DEX volume? And that was the main question that I couldn't find the answer for. And one of my end goal was to have this data. So while a lot of MEV data sets focus on, you know, mempool data, builder, like you mentioned, and everything, I wanted to reverse engineer in a place which was mainnet data, because that means I'll have full historical data. Whereas, you know, mempool data is like, it's really hard to obtain full historical data. I don't know if anyone has it. And so I thought, and also it's just so much easier, maintenance free. And the way Dune is built is there's this table that is available that is called dex.trades, and that everyone, whenever there's new marketplaces, DEX marketplaces, people add them there. So essentially the maintenance is there, and I've contributed to a lot of other tables, but that's not one of them. So I thought, you know, if I build on top of it, actually, and I manage to make a method that works solely on top of this, it should be able to sustain itself without me needing to do much maintenance. And that was something that I care about, you know, having built dashboards. You realize how big, how important maintenance is. And when you build something, people start using it and then expect you to maintain it, whether you planned on it or not. So the more I progress in this space, the more I try to look into things that minimize long-term maintenance, essentially, so that I can focus on other things later on.
Speaking of dashboards, EV, it's a I think that's such a great dashboard, probably the best out there right now. It contains everything, like the latest bundles to leaderboards and elos is actually what they added recently. They're doing some really cool stuff, and even builders. You can see which ones make profit, build a profit, validate a profit, you know, all this other snaz, how much they tip, you know, all that stuff. Have you ever gone into this kind of stuff?
So my goal isn't to be like a replacement or some kind of alternative to it. I want to present the data. This is already out there and it's great. So I don't think there's a need to replace it or do something slightly different. That would just be lost time in my eyes. So I want to, instead, I want to, you know, this data, I want to look at it in other angles, which is more the macro picture, like how is MEV growing or dwindling relative to DEX volume over time? Is it expanding? How is it looking also on other chains, which for now LibMEV is on the Ethereum? But I don't, you know, this data is awesome. If you look on like, actually, if you look on my dashboard, I link to it and I link to other dashboards that I think are pretty great. So Eigenfi is also a pretty good explorer. There's also MEVBoost.pick by Tony from the EF, which is great. But yeah, I think it'd be weird to just try to do something, do the same, but on a different platform. I'd rather do something that hasn't been shown before and try to case that.
Yeah, you were mentioning cross-chain before, cross-chain data. I don't think anybody's even done that before. How would you even look for that? Because let's say, you know, just on Ethereum, you already have private transactions, which are kind of really gatekept, need basically a builder to look at them. But maybe they just don't even send it to your builder, so then you can't really see them all. I guess in public mempools, it's probably the only thing, and end of block. How would you even approach doing that? Did you get far in doing it, or what happened?
Yeah. So the approach I chose was to use only mainnet data. So instead of using everything you mentioned, I use DEX trades that have been settled and looked into those and how I can actually reverse engineer those into, you know, flagging them as atomic arbitrage, sandwich trades or whatever. And, you know, through a bunch of heuristics, you're able to determine whether a trade is one or the other or something else. And so for example, sandwich trades, what I did is, okay, looking into this data set, what I'm looking for is to flag all the transactions that have a front run and a back run. So the same address is trading on the same pool, the same two tokens, but in different orders within the same block. And then I'm looking for at least one victim in between. And that's basically the heuristic. And if you think about it, the problem with sandwich data is there's going to be sandwiches within sandwiches, and then there's going to be overlapping, you know, like one front run is between someone else's sandwich and stuff like this. So instead, I just flagged all the transactions that had a matching back run or a matching front run and had a victim in between. So that should single out all edge cases like this and have them flagged fine. But yeah, I wanted to look at the bigger picture and flagging all those. And now I can see relative to the full DEX volume, how does that compare? And is it a big thing? How is it affected by block time, changes in block time? How does it look across chains? You know, Ethereum, you're going to see, I think across chain is different, is interesting because there's very different behaviors. So you observe that on Ethereum, there's a lot of, I was going to go on atomic arbitrage. I'll go on sandwich trades first. If you look on like chains, of course, it's very much based on the activity and how much volume there is. You know, there's not going to be much sandwich if there isn't much sandwich. But also, is the mempool like publicly available? That's going to be a big factor. And while I can't say whether a transaction has made it into the public mempool or a private one, that can always be done later to like augment the data set and somewhat backtest it. For now, you know, I focused on what I could do, and having the full history was to me what was interesting. I don't want to be only able to have the data set live, you know, for 2 months and then whoever the provider for the mempool data rugs, and then now I can't do anything. I wanted this to live in time and be able to self-sustain and update itself.
Sure. Did you ever notice any, I've always thought about this, but like a cross-chain sandwich of someone like bridging over and someone identifies that the bridge, like let's, for example, multi-chain, when you bridge over, you call the contract and you like lock it, and then you pending and you wait for it to eventually send you something on the other chain. But you see the deposit first on the first chain, and you can kind of determine, well, okay, they're going to choose one of these chains. What's more probable, I guess? You could also do with that with like statistics and probability. But then I guess you could front run that and like kind of guess if they're going to do an exchange on something. And this would be like some kind of interesting cross-chain thing. But okay, you see them exchange on one thing, you front run them by buying the DEX they're about to finish their, like, let's say, cross-chain arbitrage, for example. Like, let's say the sushi on chain A, sushi on chain B, and they buy on, you know, sushi chain A, and they want to swap it over to the other one to do the arbitrage, and somehow it's profitable. Maybe you see that and you can see them putting it in, and then you front run them by buying on exchange B, and now they're wrecked, kind of. You just reverse it.
I think so. This works, from my understanding, this kind of arbitrage works similar to SexDex arbitrage, where people, you know, will have they'll have assets on both domains. With, you know, that's something I wanted to single out and have a data set for, but I haven't been able to fully figure out all the heuristics that work, because it's much harder to distinguish those trades from normal trades. But it works the same as central exchange arbs, where, you know, people will buy high, sell low, and vice versa on the other platform. In December, my goal was to release this data set alongside Atomic Arbitrage, but I just wasn't able yet to fully nail the heuristics. So I'd rather let it breathe and take some time into thinking those over a bit more. But it is basically, you know, cross-domain arbitrage is the biggest portion, as far as I know, of MEV. There's very little data on it, though, and everyone's interested in it. When I mentioned to people that I was working on this, which I shouldn't have because people had expectation of me releasing within the time frame I gave, and I just couldn't deliver, I'd rather not deliver than give a half-baked data set that, you know, doesn't really hold up.
I think the big issue is really forming the relationship between like wallets and users on one chain and another, if they're using different wallets, right? As you say, if they're holding on one wallet on one chain, holding on another wallet, another chain, they're different addresses, somehow you're going to have to form this relationship to even track them. Otherwise, it doesn't mean anything then. It's just normal activity happening, right?
It's the same as the problem in terms of data with bridges, where it's so much work to do because you can't do it just for one chain. And also, you need to have all the chains for complete data. You need to have all the chains where the bridge is available. And that's a lot of chains, a lot of work tying. My ideal data set in terms of bridges would have, you know, a single row where you can see the chain is coming from in that transaction, as well as the chain that it was received on, as well as the transaction. But that's so much work that for now I haven't really prioritized that. But something I want to look into at some point. It's just, yeah, it's such a huge headache in terms of data. So it can already be quite complex looking into single chain things. So cross-chain data sets are, yeah, a whole other topic, I think.
I think you did a one on arbitrage as well, like arbitrage, atomic arbitrage on DEXs. Was that one you did in the past?
Yeah, and that was another interesting one where, again, through heuristics, I try to flag those. And the way I did it is, first, I look through on transactions. I look if there's at least two trades within the transaction. And I, you know, that already removes like 95% of transactions. And then for those, I look for if all the balances, summing up all the balances, changes. Like it needs to be null or positive. Otherwise, it wasn't successful. And just through this, and then you can look at just through this, or you can already flag a lot. But then I thought, okay, surely there's going to be people who do atomic arbitrage, but do other things, trade other stuff within the same transaction. You know, given like it's a free form, anyone can do anything, there surely are these edge cases. So I want to make sure that in those transactions, I only flag the trades that are part of the atomic arbitrage. So then I was kind of stuck on this for a while. And then someone recently joined Dune and actually worked on Trino, which Dune uses. So Trino is the SQL that Dune uses. And he was able to help me out. And basically, she created a method recently on Trino. And I was able to use it to essentially look for patterns. And the pattern I was looking for was loops and trying to see within transaction only flagged the parts that are a part of the loop and ignore the rest. And that way, you know, I'm much more confident in my data set going on the long term, because I think while it's probably not very common to do other things within your transaction other than atomic arbitrage, like I could see a future where, you know, it evolves into people doing all kinds of arbitrage within one transaction. And now my whole data set will be flowed. So, you know, like I said before, I want to make sure it lives well in the future and remains accurate without needing a crazy ton of maintenance. I think that's also an interesting data set. And, you know, in terms of cross-chain data, you can definitely see that the Ethereum has much more developed, much more competitive scene in terms of atomic arbitrage. And you can see by the placement of like atomic trades within the block, they're all either at the top of block, and there's something that I need to analyze a bit more. There's quite a few at the end of block as well. And I want to look into those more. My current guess would be that either they're monitoring others and, you know, doing this based on other people's trade, but also I'm guessing people are doing multiple types of arbitrage and therefore, you know, placing these after the data sandwich or whatever. And yeah, I'd be interested into figuring out what is going on exactly within those two categories of like front of block, top of block, and bottom of block.
I think I've seen actually a contract that baked into it, while it's pending, it automatically changes because of they hard-coded like Coinbase into it. And if the Coinbase was, it was like an if statement. So if Coinbase was, let's say, Titan, it would do one thing. If it was a different builder, it would do another thing, right? And that was quite interesting because I've never seen, like, I guess, dynamic pending transactions. And I think you can do some other cool stuff with that. But like going on the data set, I guess if you really wanted to look at everything, you just have to go on an archive node, for example, and just go look for every transaction. But let's say you wanted to specialize and look at your competition as an MEV searcher. Like, for example, if you want to look at Jared, well, he's done like a ton of transactions, right? So you just grab all of the blocks he's done, look at all the transactions he's done. Well, yeah, you look at all the blocks from the transactions he's done, and then you just analyze all those blocks, and something will come out of that. You know, maybe there's like a time of day or a specific kind of transaction, and you can reverse engineer strategies actually, and then their own algorithms by doing that. But we talk about patterns, and I think what makes a great data researcher is, from what I'm inferring, is, well, your heuristics. And, well, how good you are at kind of cleaning the data, if you even need to do that. But having said that, why don't you just get AI to do it and try and find all the patterns? Have you gotten into AI at all to do this? Or
I've gotten used to obviously not having AI alongside. So I've stuck to not using AI too much. I do use it, of course, a lot. I use ChatGPT, you know, like making quick scripts and everything, like quick questions, of course, like everyone. But I haven't fully factored it into my workflow. Dune has been also working on like having capabilities. So you can ask basic questions and I'll write the query for you and give you the output. But in terms of what it can do so far is like extremely limited. You know, it's going to do really basic things and we're still very far from it being something I can even consider relying on blindly. But even now, you know, the few times I use it, it's going to start like making like the skeleton for my code, where, you know, all these things that I'm always going to have in my code for, you know, pulling for that data set, which is like just tedious to always write. I'll use AI to do this and then I'll expand on it and do the more creative thinking of heuristics on top of it.
Interesting. So if you don't use AI, what do you really think kind of makes a good data analyst then?
Well, I mean, AI will, like, it'll come up eventually. You know, it's not something that I plan to never use, of course. It's just it's not there yet in terms of usage. But I'll definitely, like, I would imagine within 2024, I'm going to start increasingly using it, and to the point where it'll relying quite a bit on it by the end of the year, most probably. I think what's interesting is, first off, is understanding the blockchain. That's such a, you know, it's a basic thing, but like, it's not about how well you code. I think the code is actually much, you know, learning SQL is pretty, I'd say, easy in terms of languages. It's really not the most complex. But understanding and being able to navigate Etherscan and like knowing what is going on, why is this guy doing this? What is going on in terms of logs? Why are these events emitted? What is call data? All these basic understandings that you have of the blockchain and how it works is more important than anything, because when you're designing heuristics, you want to make sure that those come from a place where, you know, you understand what is going on. If you don't understand, you can't design good heuristics, right? And so for me, understanding the VM is the virtual machine is probably the most important. And that's also why, you know, I'm struggling right now. I'm going to eventually do more data on other chains. I want to look into Solana data, look into more Bitcoin data, Cosmos. And those are very, very different in terms of how they behave and the data. And that would be like very weird of me to suddenly say I've come up with the best method on, you know, I don't know, like my wash trading method can't be ported to other chains. Arbitrage doesn't work at all the same way. So I can't just port it on Solana and expect it to work in the same way, you know? So it's a whole mindset that now I need to understand that blockchain very, very well. Once I've nailed the understanding, or at least I'm confident, then I can start, okay, this is how people behave, and therefore this is how people do MEV, this is how people do this. And from this, what are the most simple set of heuristics, both because I want to design simple thing because they're just easier to explain. It makes for cleaner code, but also, you know, less compute heavy. So that means it runs faster and everything. So yeah, when I start designing heuristics, usually I have a ton of them, and most of them end up either being combined or not making it into the final thing because they have a really minimal or negligible impact on the whole. Yeah. So for me, understanding the blockchain you're working with is the most important thing by miles.
Okay. So when you decide to do some data analytics, what is the whole kind of pipeline you go through from getting the data set, determining the heuristics, and then releasing it? Obviously release from Dune, or if it's private, maybe something else, but what does the whole pipeline look like?
My pipeline, of course, evolves. When I started doing data more out of place of trying to understand the data than actually having understood it and trying to make sense of it. So in that regard, it was mostly looking at what other people have done and forking their queries. And then it was mind-blowing to me that I could just, someone, I don't know, had the number of holders for USDC, and I could just fork it, change into the USDT address, and then I just had a visual for USDT in like 3 seconds. And that was kind of crazy to me. I could just do this. And that was the first step. So you first learn by looking at other people's work and what they do, why they do it, trying to understand why they code in this way. I think you learn from others that are doing the same thing and are doing it better than you. And I think it's also something you got to keep in your mind and keep being open to. You know, you always have things to learn from other people in the same space. So I'm always looking at all the dashboards and what they did differently and why they did this, and then factoring in whether it's like new functions that I didn't even know about SQL, or this new data set that I didn't know was available. And then, so that is basically step one. Then step two is understanding, okay, you want to look into a specific sector. So MEV, I'm going to research everything I can find on MEV and what has been done in terms of data. And Eigen5, for example, has a small blurb on what they do to single out MEV trades. Then there's LibMEV, I think, also has a bit of this, and trying to look at what others have used in terms of methods and how I can do it efficiently first, because it doesn't port over one-to-one because it's a different language. It's a whole different data set. The format is all entirely different. And optimization in Python are going to be very different from optimizing in SQL. So you got to factor all this in. And now that you've understood those heuristics that people use, why is they use them, now you can actually apply them to the data set you have and, you know, expand on them, do some research. So you start with a base level of heuristics, then you play around with them. So you remove some, you add some, and you see how that affects the data set. Then there's some backtesting. So you mentioned Jared from Subway, and, you know, Jared is like an amazing address to just backtest with, because now I know if a certain of his transactions that are clearly MEV aren't flagged, there's something wrong in my heuristics. And if it starts flagging some of my transactions, which I'm not an MEV searcher, then it's clearly something wrong as well. You know, so it is multiple step. There's no perfect thing, but trying to cover all your grounds and make sure that you've done some good A/B testing on your data, I think is very, very important. And if the end goal to me is have something that is very easily understandable by everyone, so you want to make it seem as if like it was basically no work at all and it was just like super, super simple heuristics. And that is the prime objective, is like if anyone can understand, then I've done something really, really well and I'm happy with it. And dumbing down these heuristics to their core level where, yeah, everyone definitely agrees that, well, yeah, this makes sense. You know, given this data, this heuristic makes a ton of sense. And if people start questioning them, it means maybe either I did something wrong in the presentation or in the heuristics themselves, right? It doesn't mean, of course, my heuristics are far from perfect. There's always improvement. But I think the first step also to getting improvements is releasing the data and also listening to feedback and factoring in that feedback and, you know, adding, removing, tweaking, all these things, which I try to do because, you know, like I said before, I want my data sets to be there for the longer term. And I want to make sure those remain clean and I factor in the evolutions of things that happen on the blockchain. So there's, of course, some part of it, which is me, you know, thinking about how it's going to potentially evolve and trying to factor this in. But, you know, you obviously don't predict 90% of what's going on or what's going to happen within the next year. So, you know, things could take a really weird turn and you can't predict it. So now you've got to factor this new thing in and go back to your data set and reshape it in a way that, okay, this also works for this new behavior that wasn't there before.
I think one question I have is actually, let's say you wanted to research something and let's say there wasn't a lot of data on it. Like let's, for example, a searcher that hasn't done an insane amount of transactions. Like what's the bare minimum amount of data you need to actually make it, I guess, worth reading, valuable, I guess. And have you ever thought about synthetically creating data once you have a data set to make even more, maybe within the means, maybe an average of transactions or But yeah, how much data do you really need and what happens if you don't have a lot?
Yeah, I mean, it's always better to have a big sample size of data. And I tend to cover things that have already reached that point where there's plenty of data out there. Because also, you know, if it's like a really, really small data set, usually means there isn't that much usage yet, or it's yet to be relevant to a point where, you know, if it has reached a point where it is a relevant topic to everyone, then surely there has to be the data on chain that backs up that thing. I've never come up with that scenario, but, you know, obviously synthetic data sets would make a lot of sense to expand on the data you've got. And then, yeah, that would be the logical step. It's not something I think I'll need in the short term. In the longer term, I think we're still in the era where even basic data needs to still be tackled before we can go into more and more complex things. But my thinking is that if I, you know, now I've worked on NFT data, on NFT wash trading, I worked on MEV. But once you have all these data sets, you can go, you know, one step further and you can always expand on other people's work. And I think I'm trying to cover all areas. So I don't know, for example, another thing is I keep on updating. I have a data set of all addresses I can find that are central exchange addresses. For now, I have like close to 2,000 of them across like 300 central exchanges. And trying to have this open for anyone to use because it's such a basic building block that you can use in so many areas that, you know, it's not necessarily when looking at central exchanges, but when you look at addresses as a whole, those are important to have. And if you look at like tagging, I think the first step is manual tagging. And then on top of it, you can actually, now that I have all these central exchange addresses, I can use a bunch of heuristics to figure out what are the deposit addresses of central exchanges. What are those that, you know, and those that represent a huge bunch of addresses on Ethereum, because that's, you know, a big part of the activity. And now that means I can actually remove those from other data sets when I'm looking into other things. So, you know, it compounds. There's so much going on that if you tackle the big areas, it means the the rest is much easier to look into because now you can, you know what to blacklist, you know what to whitelist.
You can kind of combine different data to see a bigger picture. So I guess there are different sensors. You combine all the sensors to see something that you wouldn't be able to see without all of them. Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah, no, exactly. I think one of my goals would be to eventually have, I have like some dashboard tracking gas activity, activity through gas prices and current usage, and trying to see where this gas is going. What are the, you know, kind of like when you go on Etherscan and you can see like the gas tracker, like who is taking all the gas this past business hour, but also who is spending it the most. And I want to be in a place where those, all those addresses are tagged for either who they are. So I don't know, Coinbase or, you know, MEV searcher or MEV bots or whatever. And, you know, when I would love to have to be in a place where tagging is in this state where the top 100 addresses are always tagged whenever you go there. And then so it makes things so much easier because those tags, like I said, can be leveraged in so many other places.
Oh, 100%. Yeah, data really explains what's happening when you have no idea. It's a visualization. But I guess if you wanted to see, let's say you're looking at like some strategies and you see some guy, one person is already doing it. I mean, obviously you could reverse engineer it, but I guess if they to eventually sell their stuff to someone else, I don't know, I'm just thinking about the small fish. And I guess, I don't know, if you find someone or you're doing it yourself and you want to sell it, you have to create data and propose it to someone, right? But then if you have only, let's say, 10,000 transactions or 5,000, like not a lot. I mean, what would you even do with it? I guess you could make it with those transactions and kind of estimate how much you would make throughout the year, theoretically, but it's nothing hard evidence, right?
There's data is valuable and people, of course, charge and people pay for it. And the thing is, I want at least those bigger topics to not be, for the data of this behind those bigger topics to not be behind a paywall and be accessible to everyone. So that means that whenever I release something, so Wash Trading, I think, is a good example. A few weeks later, it started appearing on other places because now I had the full code, the full methodology was open. So you start seeing other places. So DeFi Llama, Shortwell later, basically copied the exact same method, the block as well, others. And I think it's good. It's a good showcase for, hopefully it's made some good impact and made the space progress because now everyone is on this level and it's not this method isn't paywalled by someone that everyone needs to rely on.
Oh, I understand. Yeah, I was thinking more of like little shops, I guess like quant shops, if they were getting into it, or if like freelancing, I don't know, data people wanted to, you know, work with different protocols to help them and they haven't got a lot of volume or anything. At that point, maybe not even worth doing it if you haven't got a lot of volume, right? But yeah, I definitely agree. Like the work you've done has definitely been a net positive, dramatic net positive. Data is always great to see where things are going, how things are going, and what needs to be adjusted or changed based on current performance and what's happening. And I mean, it reveals a lot as well that you wouldn't have seen otherwise. It's just a, you know, a couple of numbers and letters prior, and then you turn it into something visual, right? So I think it's very productive and worth a lot.
The biggest compliment usually to my stuff is, oh, that's like, that was super easy to do. That means usually, you know, I've done a decent job of like presenting it in a way that it's easy to understand. In terms of funding in general, all things, I think it's still a big problem in data because you look at things that, so either there's platforms like DeFi Llama where they have some standardized things that are in place and anyone can add themselves, but no one can skew the data into showcasing something that's hard-coded or something. Whereas if you look on what is commissioned or what is usually teams that showcase the data, the problem is they usually either pay for that data and therefore the analyst behind it sometimes is being told to showcase different things rather than necessarily what is relevant is going to be what makes them look good. And therefore, funding, you know, is kind of always it's tough because if you, like, can you rely on this obscure project that did their own data and actually all the queries are private so you can't see what the code behind it is? I could hard code anything or just change the contract that I'm looking into, and then it looks better. And yeah, so funding generally is, I think, tough to get really right in a way that what you're seeing afterwards is actually reliable and accurate. But having standardized methods, so much like DeFi Llama, for e-staking, for example, a lot of people were like, oh, can you track the supply of our LST token? But actually, if you look, for example, Coinbase, when they launched, a big part of their LST was just locked in a contract and unused and actually not representing staked ETH. So now you have all these edge cases to tackle. So instead, what I did was from the get-go, I was like, I'm just going to look at what is actually going through the deposit contract on ETH staking, and there's not going to be any, no one will ever ask me to add themselves a hard coded or anything because I just won't accept it. And standardized methods make it a lot more fair in terms of data comparison here. So, and also just maintenance wise, it's so much better than having like 50 different pipelines of people ingesting their own way.
Interesting. Well, I've definitely learned a lot about data. I've never really done it myself, but it's, you know, it's one of those things that you super enjoy using and seeing. I don't know, I never got into it, but I've always been interested in it. And it's amazing people like open source dashboards for the public when it is such valuable data, you know, you wouldn't know otherwise. But man, thank you so much for jumping on. I really appreciate it. I'm super glad you came on.
I've done a few here and there before, but I want to get more public in the medium to long term. So I hope to pop onto other places as well.
And you're going to be having your own one soon.
Oh yeah, that's another topic. I'm looking into it with two other friends and hopefully launching sometimes within the first quarter of the year. We'll see, but only start releasing when we're fully ready. But yeah, that's going to be, I'm pretty excited about this. Just hosting in general and getting also people to come on and talk about things that you're interested in. That's like super, super cool. So really looking forward to it.
I'm looking forward to it as well. We need more content. I don't think there's a lot content out there right now, especially in the tech, deep in tech. So I'm super keen. Hopefully all the best for that. And I'm waiting for it. Otherwise, thank you so much for jumping on, and probably catch you on your own podcasts.
Thank you. Thank you. Looking forward also to all the other episodes. I think it's a really, really great series to track.
Thank you very much. And I'll talk to you later.
See you. Bye-bye.